This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is David Gershon, founder and CEO of Empowerment Institute and co-director of its School for Transformative Social Change. David is author of 11 books, including Low Carbon Diet, a 30-day program to lose 5,000 pounds, winner of the 2007 Most Likely to Save the Planet Independent Publisher Book Award. David Gershon is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Social Change 2.0, A Blueprint for Reinventing Our World, winner of the 2009 National Best Books Award. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Diane. A pleasure to be on the show.
What led you to write Social Change 2.0?
Good question. A good opening question. I have been lamenting for years some of the challenges that we face in trying to bring about the kind of world that we want, the kind of social change that we want to see happen in the world, and have watched, as so many of us have, the painful, torturous process of what I call 1.0, which is trying to pass legislation to get social change to happen, or to use financial incentives to try to get social change to happen. And that system is designed for incremental change and not the kind of large-scale transformative change that's needed. So Social Change 2.0 is stepping into that vacuum and saying we ourselves as individuals in our communities can begin to bring about a lot of these changes. We don't have to wait for that system. We can begin to move this forward. We can empower people with new visions of possibility. We can enable them to change the behaviors that command and control or financial incentives are attempting to bring about. And if that system is, in fact, not working, we have no alternatives. We have to start thinking more creatively. So this is designed to build the capacity of those who want to step into this domain.
Why is it that many who wish to bring about positive social change are thwarted in their attempts?
I think that one of the beliefs is that people themselves will not change unless we force them to change through passing a law or pay them to change through creating financial incentives. There's an essential, I think, assumption about human nature that people are not predisposed. And when various types of change strategies like creating awareness campaigns fail to move people to act, the assumption is that they're not willing to act through education. And so we have to force them. But in fact, my experience is that, A, people are willing to act if provided the right tools, if inspired by a transcendent vision, sort of a Thomas Jefferson, American Dream kind of a vision that lifts them. And so we as change agents need to raise the level of our play, need to really try new things that haven't been tried before. We need to reinvent social change, which is what I'm trying to do here by creating what I call Social Change 2.0, which starts to operate with these assumptions. And we've got 30 years of research, so this is not a theory. It's really a set of practices that we've seen work.
In part one of your book, you describe four experiments in social transformation that provided you with insights about the most effective way to bring about positive social change. Would you like to give an overview of these experiments and what you learned from them?
Well, I would say they were all trying to do some different things. And probably the deepest dive was taking on the issue of sustainable living in America. And one of the things that we observed was that people were struggling with four questions. And this also applies to lowering our carbon footprint or creating low-carbon lifestyles as well as environmentally sustainable lifestyles. But it also applies to how we might create livable neighborhoods or more disaster-resilient communities where you have to engage people, where the solution demands that people do something differently and that a lot of people do something differently, and that it has the ability to scale so that we can begin to create replicable solutions that can work in many different communities. Those were some of the challenges that we were trying to tackle, and there are many. And what those four experiments represent are 20 years of really being in the trenches, working in some 25 cities with several hundred thousand people over time in many countries, as well as a very deep dive with 20,000 people in this country. So One issue, the ability to get people to create more environmentally sustainable lifestyles, or if you will, to begin to reduce their environmental impact. That was where we started in 1989, and we began to ask the question, if Americans, in fact, want to do the right thing, which all the research was showing, why is it that they're not? And we found that there were four questions that people were asking. I don't know where to start. I don't know which are the important actions. I don't know how to take those actions. And if I did take them, it would seem to me that it's just a drop in the bucket, so why bother? And we knew that we had to answer those questions deeply, or else we would not be able to get people to actually adopt new behaviors. And we also found that while people were recycling, now, of course, Seattle is pushing the envelope on almost every environmentally sustainable lifestyle, but we worked in Portland, and we found, for example, that in Portland, which had one of the highest recycling rates in the country, through this program we ultimately developed, we were able to get people to almost double what they were recycling by virtue of how to really work with them in this new way. So the potential is there not just for people that are unaware, but for people who are aware who just haven't figured out how to take it to the next level. So all that said, what we began to experiment with was a structured program, a green living program. We called it the EcoTeam program, around this notion of a peer support system, which was a very foundational element to get people to sustain their commitment, to follow through, to do all the things that they knew they should do, but they just weren't quite getting their act together. And what we found was that we were able to get people to reduce, and this is across the country, from places like Portland, Oregon, to Philadelphia, to Columbus, Ohio. So quite a wide diversity. We're able to get people to reduce their solid waste by something like 41%, their energy use by, I think, 17%, their vehicle miles traveled by 8%, their water use by 31%, their carbon footprint by 15%, and they were saving close to $300. And this is based on before and after assessments with some 20,000 U.S. residents. So we saw that we could change behavior. Once we found that we could get people to actually reduce their environmental footprint, the next question was, how do you get people to actually participate? And how do you get enough people to make a difference? And I think this will pertain to all the other initiatives that were part of that first chapter. We found the idea ultimately of getting neighbors to talk to neighbors was one of the missing things that was going on in the culture in this country. And that if you could create a program that was neighborhood-based, that invited people, neighbor inviting another neighbor, to come to their home to hear about a program that was helping conserve resources for the sake of our children, get to know each other better as neighbors, and create a healthier, more livable neighborhood. When that message was communicated by one neighbor to another, 85% of the people were interested in coming, half came, and 75% joined this program. And we were getting a participation rate of 25% on the block. And we were finding that in all of these different communities. So a behavioral change program that's carefully structured to help people move into action like a recipe format with this peer support group process of an eco team in this case, and the wherewithal to scale it through a very careful recruitment process of neighbor to neighbor with lots of training and support. That became the core model of how we actually engage people in behavioral change. We then apply that to creating disaster-resilient communities around the issue of emergency preparedness in New York City. In the past, post 9/11, the city asked me to come in and build a program for them around that issue. And we did the same thing around livability in inner-city neighborhoods like Philadelphia or Kansas City, Missouri, around how to bring people together in crime-ridden, drug-ridden neighborhoods that traditionally have people feeling disenfranchised from the government and from their neighbors and not even wanting to go out the door. And again, we were finding in that case 60% participation and endless numbers of new kinds of capabilities built in these neighborhoods. I mean, each of these is a whole story, a whole chapter in the book, but those became some of my core learnings, at least on the behavioral change front.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is David Gershon, author of the book Social Change 2.0, A Blueprint for Reinventing Our World. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. In your view, what most motivates people to change and to adopt behaviors that are more compatible with long-term well-being and transformative change?
Well, Diane, what I see, and the key to this, and the analogy I used earlier, is Thomas Jefferson and the idea of the American dream. We have built a vision of what this country, not to say we're living it as fully as we might wish, but still, relative to other places, we have this place where people are invited to dream, where people are invited to see new possibilities, where there is the belief that one can make one's life as one wishes it, that the conditions are here to do that, whether we choose to do that, whether we fully avail ourselves of a culture that enables that is a different story. But the idea there was inspiring someone with a vision of possibility. And that has been the heart of this work, the heart of the empowerment. There's five different design principles, and one of them is the practice of empowerment. And that's where I've spent a lot of time over the last 30 years building out this core methodology to help someone envision and create what it is they want in their lives at a personal level. I apply that to organizations, to communities, and around various social change initiatives. So the key is a vision that pulls me so that I don't have to be pushed. If something is out there, kind of like the sun that I want to go towards, then I am motivated intrinsically. It's the dream that's pulling me rather than me having to be pushed by someone telling me I have to do this by a law or being told, here's some money, go do it. But if there's something that I want, for example, that's what we had in the neighborhood-based programs. I want to know my neighbors. I want to live in a place that I feel safe in. I want to be able to have a place where my children can go to a neighbor if I'm not able to come home on time to meet them. I want a healthier place to live. So when you bring all those things together, you've got this pull. And so that's the idea of vision. And then the structure, the tools that I laid out that help people act on it. It's ideal if I could have that, but I don't know how to make that happen. So if you create the structure, the careful structure that moves people through the steps to make the changes they would like, then you have the ingredients.
Would you say more about what that structure is to make people become more empowered and bring about their vision of transformative social change?
Well, it depends on the issue. But the ones that I was describing, the structure was the peer support system / peer pressure / peer support. So there's the support side and there's the pressure side. There's the accountability to other people, to my neighbors. The pulls are getting to know my neighbors. The pulls are safer, healthier. The pulls are higher quality of life. In New York City for the resiliency program, the pull was resiliency as a new quality of life indicator in a city that was threatened by terrorism and by other kinds of threats. So those are the things that you get to use to pull. In other initiatives, one of the other initiatives that we're doing is we have been invited into Afghanistan to help build empowerment programs for disenfranchised women. And part of the process there is just opening up the question, what do you want? Do you know it is possible to have it be different? And then we've created this whole empowerment workshop process that we train trainers in, and they train these 5,000 women. And it's really one of the relatively unknown success stories in Afghanistan. And we've now created something we call the Global Initiative for the Empowerment of Women. And this is going now in Darfur and in South Africa and in Nigeria and in a number of places, including Afghanistan. Again, a structure, a very carefully crafted structure, workshop experience with follow-up support, well-skilled facilitators creating the same basic idea of helping people envision and create what they want, in this case, in all the different areas of their life, and then beginning to look at how to move that into society after they've now gone through this personal experience, which is foundational in these places because the enculturation is so profound, the disenfranchisement is so profound. And we saw that also in the inner cities of America. So again, this is what social change too looks like on the ground. It's fundamentally transformational. It opens up new possibilities. It does not depend on someone coming in with money, per se, other than the basics to build the capacity, doesn't depend on a law being passed, although those things certainly reinforce and support it. It really is about empowering people.
Would you go into a bit more detail about how people are persuaded to join the program and training?
Well, it depends on which things we're talking about. But going back to the community-based behavior change initiatives that I described earlier, people will join through peers, social networks, friends, workplaces. It can happen, you know, if it's, let's say, an environmentally sustainable lifestyle or a low-carbon diet, which is a carbon reduction program that we're running now in some 300 cities around the country. Same model, and they're getting a 25% carbon footprint reduction also. That's a whole other thing we should touch on because that's a big deal also for Seattle, which I know is still working hard to get people engaged at the residential level. So the key then to that question is peers, peer pressure, peer support, social connectivity. It's not even pressure. It's really social connectivity, spending more time in community. And at the level of the block, it's getting to know my neighbors. At the level of a workplace, it's being able to have quality time with my colleagues. At the level of a faith-based group, it's being able to work with fellow congregants. But it's the social connectivity connected to the social issue and then the structure that enables people to actually not just come together and hang out and have a sense of community, but actually as a community. We call it, you know, either an eco team or a livability team or a low carbon diet team, perform against their social aspirations. You know, I want to lower my carbon footprint. I want to live a more sustainable lifestyle. I want to create a safer, healthier neighborhood. I want to create a more disaster resilient building or block.
Would you speak about the use of a whole systems approach in social change too?
Well, one thing that we do when we go into a community is that we try to bring the whole system together. So, for example, in Philadelphia, with our livability program, our livable neighborhood program, we're usually brought in by the local government. But we wanted to bring the local nonprofits, the neighborhood associations, everybody who needs to be part of helping those individuals on a block create a more livable neighborhood. In the case of our disaster resiliency program, we again worked with the City of New York Office of Emergency Management. We also worked with the fire department, the police department. We worked with so many different agencies. We also worked with the major local nonprofits who are on the ground doing all the community organizing. The idea is that we have to work in this synergistic way, that if we do these initiatives solo, which often happens in communities, the government will do something, the NGOs will do something, but working together, it's hard. It's much easier to do your own thing, but you can't get the results, and you certainly can't scale anything without the whole system working together.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is David Gershon, author of the book Social Change 2.0, A Blueprint for Reinventing Our World. Let's focus now on the low-carbon diet and cool community movement as an example of social change, too.
Yeah.
You've been alluding to it, but perhaps you could tell us how it started.
Well, the big question that I have been tackling is on the climate change front, seeing how stuck we are with Copenhagen breaking down, how much struggle there is to get any legislation passed, not to mention substantial legislation passed, and where the carbon's actually coming from. So when one does an analysis around that issue, this is some of the facts. Half of America's carbon footprint comes out of our daily lifestyles, the fossil fuels we use to drive our cars and provide energy to our homes. That's where half of the footprint comes from. And in a community, minimally, 50% of the footprint of a community, up to 90% if there's not a lot of business, comes out of the residential sector. That is the lever. So that's one fact. Fact two, conservation, energy efficiency, is the low-hanging fruit. That's the place where we have the most potential to actually reduce carbon in the short term. Fact three, according to our climate scientists, we have a small window to make change. We don't have the luxury of time to wait for the new technologies to scale up, for renewable energies to scale up. Those things most people say will not be at scale for at least a decade, if not longer. And we need to make changes in the short term. So when one looks at that, the place where we have the most opportunity to get the most carbon reduced in the short term is how we live our lives. The question has been how to actually affect that kind of change, because most people just think of this as changing light bulbs and not really a coherent process or a scalable process. So what the low-carbon diet program, which we tested in Portland in 2000 and then took out into the world in 2006, attempts to do is to move someone systematically through their lifestyle and have got 24 actions. Each has a number associated with carbon reduction. And then it has the peer support system. And then it has the ability to invite others to get involved. And then the cool community is how one scales that. And that's a whole strategy that I've begun to speak to. So because of the paucity of resources and the recognition that this is an opening, through a collaboration with Al Gore, we began creating this teletraining in early 2007, and it took off. And we've now trained some 300 communities to participate in these cool community initiatives, and it's quite amazing what's happening. It's the counterpoint to, I guess, the story that we can't do this because government's broken. We can. And in fact, the good news is that as you engage people, they start creating demand for the green products and services to build the low-carbon economy that America is pinning its future against or on. And it also brings the community together in the ways that I described, the social cohesiveness. So the sustainability agenda starts to get addressed directly. And it also starts to build low-carbon literacy and demand for bolder legislation at the local, state, and federal level. So it is a very synergistic whole system intervention around the issue of climate change.
Would you go into detail about efforts to have cool communities statewide in Massachusetts?
Well, the state of Massachusetts is one of 17 states that have committed to having major legislation. And what their legislation looked at was getting up to 25% footprint reduction, carbon footprint reduction by 2020. When they looked at what that would take, they realized that they were not set up to achieve that. And what began to be very clear was that half of the footprint was the residential sector. So this organization, Massachusetts Climate Action Network, MCAN, approached us and said, we want to step in. They had actually helped get the legislation passed. They are a statewide climate change organization that's doing fantastic work, a real model for other states. And they've got about 50 cities that are part of this network. And they said, let's see if we can collaborate. Again, synergy and collaboration. And we launched this thing we called the Cool Mass. And the goal was 25-25-2012. 25% of the state's population reducing its footprint, 25% by 2012. And we put out the call to see who would step forward. And we got 47 cities interested. We chose 10. And their goal was to get up to 85% of the population of their community to reduce their footprint using the whole cool community model and its all its templates by 25%. And we're off and running. We've got probably half of them, half of those communities are off. They've got started. They've gotten the organizations involved. They're getting eco-teams started. They're putting it out. They're starting what the sort of motto is the second American Revolution and letting Massachusetts be the shot fired around the country or the world of what's possible when people step forward. I think it's just really extraordinary what's going on in Massachusetts.
Overall, what are the barriers to scaling up the Cool Communities campaign so that the effort reaches the majority of people and goes beyond just the most devoted?
Well, you know, one of the key ideas, another one of the chapters in Social Change 2.0, is the idea of disproportionate leverage, disproportionate influence leverage, or the diffusion of innovation, how you get a new idea to spread. And there's a guy named Everett Rogers out of Stanford University who wrote a book called Diffusion of Innovation. He studied 1,500 case studies over 50 years of successful innovations from new seed strains for farmers to new medicines for doctors that were successfully able to diffuse. And what he found was there were four groups of people that respond to an innovation. The early adopters, who seek out the new and have a high tolerance for experimentation, they represent 15% of the population. The early majority, the next 35% who are the belongers. The next group called the late majority who eventually will come along, and the late majority is also 35%. And the laggards, which are 15% who will never participate. And the idea, he said, is that when you get to 15%, if the innovation is capable of going to scale, you hit a tipping point where it starts diffusing on its own momentum. And so what we are targeting to do is to identify those early adopter states, the early adopter communities, the early adopter neighborhoods and organizations, and let this kind of elegant strategy that diffusion of innovation speaks to. What Rogers basically said is preach to the choir, because they'll sing loud enough to get everyone into the church. It's kind of almost exactly the opposite of how most social change is trying to be promulgated, which says don't preach to the choir. In effect, what they say is preach to the laggards. And laggards, in fact, throw cold water on ideas. So part of what I'm trying to do in my book is to provide some of this research, hard-won research, as well as some of the best practices that are out there on how one can successfully move a social innovation forward. Because, in fact, most of us haven't thought hard around the issue of social change. If you start asking, what's your social change strategy? What are your assumptions about people? You know, most people don't have good answers to that. Or if they do, it's kind of like the very conventional, well, you have to do laws because human nature will just be the way it is. We won't do anything. So that's the strategy we're using. And will it succeed? Remains to be seen. Will us we rise to the challenge of climate change? This is the civilizational question that we are being asked to deal with. And I believe it's possible. I believe that particularly if we build more capacity among change agents, I think the onus is on us, those who call themselves change agents, which is how I see myself, those who see themselves as here to change the world, we have to just build our capacity. And I believe that people are ready if we can work smarter and more skillfully.
How can listeners find out more about your Cool Communities campaign?
Well, there's two websites, but the starting point would be going to empowermentinstitute.net, www.empowermentinstitute.net, and we do Cool Community teletrainings on the homepage. Right on the top of the homepage, you'll see the next teletraining, March 11th, and they can participate in that. They can also go to the section of the website on low-carbon diet, and there they can learn everything they want to know about it, including all the tools that are available at no charge for them to use, like our global warming cafes and other things. And then the other website is www.socialchange2.com, where they can really learn more about the book I wrote, which has all the organizing strategies and specifically one on the Cool Community Initiative.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I would say, Diane, the message is, yes, we can. Some wonderful person has put that into the vocabulary. My favorite embattled president, and yes, we can. And I think to the extent, by the way, that we do this, we will provide a whole new capability for the 1.0 system so it can move forward more effectively, the one that he's trying to cajole to get out of its slumber. But yes, we can. The tools are available. I believe people are ready. I think these resources that we've developed, this book, I think can help. I think that this is the time, and we need to do it. And we are, and we can do it better.
Well, thanks so much for being here, David.
It is my pleasure. And thank you for having me on your show, and thank you for having a show that asks these questions. It's a great honor to be part of it.
Thank you. You have just been listening to David Gershon, author of the book Social Change 2.0, A Blueprint for Reinventing Our World, published in 2009 by High Point Chelsea Green Publishing. For more information, check on the web at socialchange2.com. Again, that's socialchange2, that's the numeral 2.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.